And he does refer to him as one of the greatest American political philosophers, if not the greatest American political philosopher. And what Calhoun does, among other things, in this book, The Disquisition on Government, is to present an exposition of what today is known as libertarian class theory. It's different than Marxian class theory, where the relevant classes are the working class and the capitalist class. And under libertarian class theory, which goes back 100 years or more before Calhoun's time, the two classes are the net taxpayers and the net tax consumers. As he says, there are two groups in any democracy. One group that pays more in taxes than it receives in any benefits from government. The second group is the opposite. They receive more in benefits than they pay in taxes, and that would be heavily skewed towards government employees, politicians, bureaucrats of all kinds, recipients of governmental largesse, and so forth. And so the tax-consuming class exploits the tax-paying class. That's the class conflict in libertarian class theory. So it has nothing to do with Marxian class theory. Let's see. Let me see what I have a note here about the Mises. Can I try the communicate menu, speaker mic test? Let me try that. We did the mic test. That's good. Okay, so getting back to Calhoun, this is libertarian class theory. And so let me go through some of the basic arguments that Calhoun made there. And of course, Calhoun was a very influential figure. He was a vice president of the United States, the United States Senator, Congressman, Secretary of War. I consider him to be the last of the founding fathers' generation in terms of philosophy. He died in 1850, but philosophically, he was probably the last writer, a political philosopher who wrote like Madison and Jefferson and the rest in terms of his philosophy of government. Much more Jefferson than Madison. Okay, and so there it is, the Wikipedia entry on Calhoun there on the chat group. And he was a favorite of Rothbard, as I said. And that's another thing I like about Rothbard, because Calhoun is politically incorrect because, after all, he was from South Carolina, and South Carolina had slaves at the time that he wrote, but so did New York City at the time that he wrote. And so his ideas have been besmirched, denigrated, smeared, libeled for many generations. Not so much because he lived in a slave state and he was a Southerner, but because they posed a challenge to the unlimited authority of the state. I think that's the real reason why so many people in academia especially think that Calhoun should just not even be brought up. If you mention Calhoun's name to some people, case closed, no matter what your argument is, your argument must be false. But Murray Rothbard didn't buy into that. He knew that was all baloney. And so he didn't buy into that that political correctness in his day. Okay, let me see. Let me look at the chat here. Somebody still can't hear? I have a bunch of people saying the sound is much better, and one person saying can't hear. Okay. Okay, so the arguments, Calhoun starts out in his essay talking about a tendency in human society for what he called a universal state of conflict. And so he looks at human beings where conflict is inevitable. And so he lays out really the case, sort of the natural rights case for government, where the idea being, coming from John Locke and other Scottish Enlightenment philosophers, that human beings have natural God-given rights to life, liberty, and property, and that the purpose of government, therefore, is solely to secure those rights to life, liberty, and property. And so what it is government to do to secure those rights, it is only to protect us from one another whenever there is aggression of one person against another, criminality, you know, theft, murder, and so forth, and also to supposedly protect us from foreign aggressors. So to protect members of society from those the wolves among them, and also the wolves in, so to speak, in foreign countries who would attack them. And of course, he says, but government has a tendency to abuse its powers. So there's the conundrum. He says the standard classic case for government says we want government to protect us from aggressors, but then who will protect us from the government? Is the second question. You know, government does have this propensity to abuse its powers. So how is this going to work? He goes through a brief discussion of history, and he says, well, historically, people have looked at superstition, religion, and also education. You're trying to get this problem solved. I'm still looking at the chat here. It sounds like sound is better. Okay, so I'll keep on going. And so let me read a great quotation on the 8th page of the essay, where he addresses this conundrum. He says, there is but one way in which this can possibly be done, and that is by such an organism as will furnish the rule with the means of resisting successfully this tendency on the part of the rulers to oppression and abuse power. Power can only be resisted by power, and tendency by tendency. Those who exercise power and those subject to its exercise, the rulers and the ruled, stand in antagonistic relations to each other. The same constitution of our nature which leads rulers to oppress the ruled, regardless of the object for which government is ordained, will, with equal strength, lead the ruled to resist when possessed of the means of making peaceable and effective resistance. And he's talking about suffrage, voting. So Calhoun is saying that, the first step along the way to avoiding total tyranny or despotism is suffrage or the right to vote. But he's not naive, of course. And then he goes on to say that, suffrage will only work in preventing abuse of power if essentially everyone agrees with everything. It only works with uniformity of interests. As long as interests are different among different groups in society, then there will be this constant struggle by one group to control the government, to abuse its power, to plunder the other group. It's inevitable. Only in a society where the interests are common could this possibly work. And so that would imply, by the way, that only in very small societies would there ever be any hope of having government actually work the way the theorists say it's supposed to work. And so conflict is inevitable. And this is a very old idea, of course, and modern economists refer to this phenomenon as political externalities. And this phrase was probably coined by my old professor, James M. Buchanan, the economist, the Nobel Prize-winning economist who taught at George Mason for many years. He taught at Virginia Polytechnic Institute when I was a graduate student there, way back when the dinosaurs still roamed the earth. But one of his first publications out of graduate school in the 1940s was an article about political externalities, pointing out the fact that in a majority-ruled democracy, it's inevitable that since we don't have uniformity of interests, one group will impose what are called political externalities on another group. That's sort of a polite way of saying one group, the bigger group, the majority, will plunder the minority under democracy. There's another great quote. I think it's worth my while to repeat some of these quotes, because Rothbard did in so many writings of his, because he thought it was just so spot on, just so right on, that he quoted at great length some of the parts of the disposition of government. And so here's one of my favorites, and Rothbard's also. when once formed, the he's talking about a political community. When once formed, the community will be divided into two great parties, a major and a minor, between which there will be incessant struggles on the one side to retain and on the other to obtain the majority, and thereby the control of the government and the advantages it confers. So deeply seated, indeed, is this tendency to conflict between the different interests or portions of the community that it would result from the action of the government itself, even though it were possible to find a community where the people were all of the same pursuits, placed in the same condition of life and in every respect so situated as to be without inequality of condition or diversity of interest. The advantages of possessing the control of the powers of government, and thereby its honors and emoluments, are of themselves exclusive of all other considerations, ample to divide even such a community into two great hostile parties. And so therefore he's talking about the taxpayers versus the tax consumers. At least it's one spot where he's talking about that. Then he goes on to say this: it must necessarily follow that some one portion of the community must pay in taxes more than it receives back in disbursements, while another receives in disbursements more than it pays in taxes. It is then manifest, taking the whole process together, that taxes must be, in effect, bounties to that portion of the community which receives more in disbursements than it pays in taxes, while to the other which pays in taxes more than it receives in disbursements, they are taxes in reality, burdens instead of bounties. This consequence is unavoidable and results from the nature of the process to be the taxes ever so equally laid and the disbursements ever so fairly made in reference to the public services. And so, and this is certainly relevant to today's discussion. I think last week all the news was all abuzz over Mitt Romney's comment about 47% of American workers who pay no federal income tax, implying that they're moochers and parasites. And I wrote an article about it on LouRockwell.com entitled "What Ron Paul Might Have Said About That 47%," and it was filled with quotations from Calhoun from this book that I'm reading to you tonight, because the timing was pretty perfect. And let me go on to say what else Calhoun says. Another important point that he makes, he says, the necessary result of all this, then, of the unequal fiscal action of the government is to divide the community into two great classes, one consisting of those who in reality pay the taxes and, of course, bear the exclusively the burden of supporting the government, and the other of those who are the recipients of their proceeds through disbursements and who are in fact supported by the government, or in fewer words, to divide it into taxpayers and tax consumers. So it's taxpayers versus tax consumers. And of course, it's not always the exact same people. These coalitions are constantly shifting and changing. But the effect of this is to place them in antagonistic relations in reference to the fiscal action of the government and the entire course of policies therewith connected. For the greater the taxes and disbursements, the greater the gain of the one and the loss of the other, and vice versa. And consequently, the more the policy of the government is calculated to increase taxes and disbursements, the more it will be favored by the one and opposed by the other. And so this was the great dilemma of democratic government in the eyes of Calhoun. And he goes on to talk about how a mere constitution would never be enough to constrain government. The separation of powers in the United States Constitution was an attempt at what you might call horizontal control of government. The theory was that if the powers of government are divided between the three branches, the executive, judicial, and legislative, then power would counteract your power. That, of course, has not worked out that way. The way in which it has worked out is that the three branches of government collude and conspire against the people. A perfect example of that is how the Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts, invented all sorts of strange and bizarre language a couple of months ago in order to say that somehow in the Constitution it allows for socialized medicine, or Obamacare, as it's called popularly. And so that has always been the case. That is for a long, long time in the United States, that the role of the Supreme Court has been essentially to rubber stamp all legislation passed by the Congress so that the public is told to just shut up and take it, and you have no role here. It wasn't always that case that way in the United States, but that's the way it is today. And of course, Calhoun foresaw this, that this would be the way it would work out, which is why he said that the division of powers, or the separation of powers, was simply not enough to guarantee avoidance of tyranny. Okay, and so that's what he's talking about. He talks about how the tax-paying group, which would never stop at anything, they would be lying, conniving, manipulating, political activists who would have no use at all for the words of the Constitution. I mean, certainly is right. In the book, The Constitution in Exile, Andrew Napolitano pointed out that the United States Supreme Court did not veto a single federal law as unconstitutional from the year 1937 until 1995, and very little after that. So the Supreme Court has essentially been a rubber stamp on everything. And that even was the intent of the Hamiltonian faction of the American founders, led by Alexander Hamilton himself. The Hamilton's view of the Constitution, as I explained in my book, Hamilton's Curse, was that if properly interpreted by clever lawyers like himself, clever statist lawyers like himself, the Constitution could someday be used as a rubber stamp of approval on just about anything the government ever wanted to do. It was Hamilton who invented the theory of implied powers in the Constitution as opposed to the explicit written out powers of the Constitution. And so he essentially laid the groundwork for generations of lawyers and politicians to subvert the Constitution. And I'm going to talk more about that in a little bit. But the Jeffersonian view was the opposite view. Jefferson himself was known as a strict constructionist, and the Jeffersonians, rather naively, I guess, hoped that the Constitution could be enforced and that the actual words of the Constitution could be used to limit government. Whereas the other faction, the nationalists, they wanted to use the Constitution as a rubber stamp document for unlimited government, and of course that faction has won out in American society. And so what else can be done? Calhoun is famous for what he calls the concurrent majority, the idea of a concurrent majority. And in a nutshell, or in essence, he proposed this, that any federal legislation should be able to be vetoed or disavowed, threatened peacefully by any group of citizens or states that in their opinion thought it was unconstitutional. The federal government should not be given a monopoly in constitutional interpretation. This was certainly the view of all the Jeffersonians from Jefferson on throughout the 19th century, and Calhoun was surely a Jeffersonian in this regard. It wasn't until after the American Civil War that Americans adopted this idea that the Supreme Court is the sole decision maker with regard to constitutionality or the judicial decisions regarding what the limits of the federal government ought to be. The Jeffersonians, including Calhoun, warned for generations that if the day ever came when the federal government would become the sole arbiter of the limits of its own power, then there would soon be no limits of its power. And that, of course, is exactly what happened. So Calhoun was very prescient in that regard. And so he essentially was advocating a nullification vote, a means by which citizens themselves, the voters, the citizens, could organize in political communities at the state and local level, tell the federal government, we are sovereign, we the people are sovereign, and we the people do not believe that this law is constitutional, therefore we will not enforce it within our state. And that's essentially what Calhoun is saying. And there's another excellent quote on the 20th page of his essay I'd like to get into a little bit about he's talking about an error of interpretation that a lot of people have about government. And he says this, this is his case for a concurrent majority. A written constitution certainly has many and considerable advantages, but it is a great mistake to suppose that the mere insertion of provisions to restrict and limit the powers of the government without investing those for whose protection they are inserted with the means of enforcing their observance will be sufficient to prevent the major and dominant party from abusing its powers. Being the party in possession of the government, they will, from the same constitution of man, which makes government necessary to protect society, be in favor of the powers granted by the Constitution and opposed to the restrictions intended to limit them. As the major and dominant party, they will have no need for these restrictions for their protection. The ballot box of itself will be ample protection for them because they are the minority. Needing no other, they would come in time to regard these limitations as unnecessary and improper restraints to endeavor to elude them with the view of increasing their power and influence, end quote. In other words, they would start calling it the living constitution, and they would start using words like the implied powers of the constitution, as Hamilton did, of course. And so Calhoun, of course, knew all about Hamilton and his tricks. And the Hamiltonians, after Hamilton died in 1804, his political descendants did all of these things. So the Calhoun was just not making these theories up out of thin air. He had observed the advocates of unlimited government in his time, in politics, in America, doing all of these things. And he goes on to say on the 21st page that the party in favor of the restrictions would be overpowered. That is, the party in favor of restrictions in the Constitution on the government. At first, they might command some respect and do something to stay the march of encroachment, but they would, in the progress of the context, be regarded as mere abstractionists, and indeed, deservedly, if they should indulge the folly of supposing that the party in possession of the ballot box and the physical force of the country could successfully be resisted by an appeal to reason, truth, justice, or the obligations imposed by the Constitution. For when these of themselves shall exert sufficient influence to stay the hand of power, then the government will be no longer necessary to protect society, nor constitution is needed to prevent government from abusing its power. The end of a contest should be the subversion of the Constitution, either by the undermining process of construction, for its meaning would admit of possible doubt, or by substituting in practice what is called party usage in place of its provisions, or finally, when no other contrivance would subserve the purpose, by openly and boldly setting them aside. Okay, the government would be converted into one of unlimited powers. And no more certain truth has ever been spoken by a political theorist in America anyway. And so that was, in Calhoun's own words, his case for some sort of concurrent majority or nullification, essentially. And I'm just going to check out the chat group here. It looks like I've got a lot of chatting going on, which is good. I just want to make sure there's nobody saying I can't hear or see or something like that. Okay. Okay, so this view was not just the view of Hamilton, or Calhoun. It was also the view of other Jeffersonians. One book I would recommend on this, the book on the Jeffersonian interpretation of the U.S. Constitution, is by a man named St. George Tucker, and it's called A View of the Constitution of the United States. St. George Tucker was Thomas Jefferson's law professor at the College of William and Mary. And so he taught law to Jefferson. And so his book, A View of the Constitution, outlines the Jeffersonian view of interpretation of the United States Constitution, which was eclipsed in the 19th century after the American Civil War, and all but forgotten. And the actual book has been reprinted in recent years, so you can actually buy it if you want to buy a hard copy of it. I don't know if it's online or not. And so people like St. George Tucker warned long before Calhoun's time that it was a grave mistake to ever give the decision-making powers put it, to put it solely in the hands of the federal government with regard to the constitutionality of federal legislation. They ridiculed this idea. They thought that it would lead to absolute tyranny if you allow the government itself to decide the limits of its own powers through its own judiciary. That's why they thought that the whole idea of so-called states' rights or federalism is that if the people are ever to control their government, which is supposed to be their agent, then they would have to do it themselves through political communities organized at a stable local level, not through the government's own courts. After all, federal judges are federal bureaucrats. They're paid by the federal government, and that's who they owe their allegiance to, not the taxpayers per se, not the people of the states per se. Okay. And so this view was not only held by Jefferson and his law professor, but many others from the 19th century and all states in America. And of course, it was before Calhoun's time. Jefferson is known for his famous Kentucky Resolve Resolution, so the Kentucky Resolution of 1798. And this was a response to the Sedition Act, which made free political speech illegal in America during the Adams administration. John Adams was George Washington's successor as president. He was the second president of the United States. The first thing the Nationalists, the party of Hamilton, did when they got in power is to outlaw criticisms of the government. And they put dozens of people in prison, a lot of newspaper journalists, even a member of congressman named Lyons, L-Y-O-N-S, from Vermont, who was a critic of John Adams, went to jail for criticizing the president and his administration. And so Jefferson used this idea of nullification to write the famous Kentucky Resolve of 1798, which essentially said that the government of the United States is a compact among the states. The citizens of the states are sovereign. Therefore, they have an equal say with the president, with the Congress, with the Supreme Court, with any other body of government on constitutional issues. And we believe the outlawing of free speech is unconstitutional. Just read the First Amendment. They didn't say exactly those words, just read the First Amendment, but that's what they meant. And so therefore, we, the people of Kentucky, he went on to say, will not abide by this federal law. James Madison did the same thing for Virginia in this famous Virginia Resolution of 1798, the year 1798. And so this all preceded Calhoun, but Calhoun got some of his ideas from these men. Then you had the New Englanders during the Jefferson administration. Thomas Jefferson as president, and he took office in the year 1801, imposed a trade embargo because the British were confiscating American ships and impressing American sailors and forcing them to join them in their war with France. And so rather than go into another war with France, Jefferson chose a second best alternative, the trade embargo, and the New England states essentially used his own words of nullification to nullify the trade embargo, to not participate. And they did the same thing when the War of 1812 came along. The New England states essentially did not participate in the War of 1812. They essentially seceded from the Union during the War of England, in the War of 1812. And so, and they used Jefferson's own words about this. South Carolinians issued what they called an ordinance of nullification in the year 1832 to state that they would not collect a new 45% average tariff rate on imports. They thought it was unconstitutional and that it disproportionately harmed them and their economy. And so they said, we will not collect it at Charleston Harbor. There were northern states that had issued ordinances of nullification claiming that they would not enforce the Fugitive Slave Act, which was a federal law that forced northern states to run down runaway slaves and return them to their owners. And then also a number of states intervened to try to kick out of their borders the Bank of the United States, which was the precursor to the Fed, or the Central Bank, it was the first central bank in America, and President Andrew Jackson was known for vetoing the recharter of it, federal law that would have rechartered it in the 1830s, and the Bank of the United States did die out. But Andrew Jackson had a lot of help from state legislatures, and the citizens of the states, especially Ohio, did a lot of things, including imposing very heavy taxes on branches of this federal or national bank that operated within their boundaries, within the state boundaries. And so these ideas of the citizens having control over their own government were really at the heart of what Calhoun is talking about here. And his scheme or his plan for a concurrent majority was just one example of what he thought could be done to help citizens continue this sort of thing, which New Englanders had done, Virginians had done, South Carolinians had done for 50 years by the time Calhoun got around to writing this book, his disposition on government. And so these were not just Calhoun's ideas, but this was his articulation of the Jeffersonian viewpoint with regard to the Constitution and how to interpret the Constitution. There's another article that I've published on this topic that is relevant here. It's on newrockwell.com, and it's called The Founding Fathers, plural, Founding Fathers of Constitutional Subversion. And it is also republished in a different form in this book, which I'll hold out. You can see the title there. It's called Rethinking the American Union for the 21st Century. It's edited by Donald Livingston. It's a book of essays. And I talked about it in my federalism class. And there are essays by Donald Livingston, Kent Masterson Brown, myself, Marshall DeRosa, Patrick Sale, and Yuri Maltsev, and Rob Williams. And in my essay, I go through the history of constitutional subversion that illustrates exactly what Calhoun is talking about here. And in particular, he was talking about, in American politics, what is known as the nationalists. The nationalists in the American political tradition are also known as the Hamiltonians. And these are the people who had no use for constitutional restrictions on government that Calhoun referred to. And he had observed these people in action for many, many years. It was Hamilton, as I said, who in his debate with Jefferson over the constitutionality of the central bank, of the Bank of the United States, invented the idea of implied powers of the Constitution. Okay? And that really, once you go down that road, and once it becomes accepted that there is such a thing as implied powers of the Constitution, as opposed to the explicit defined powers of government in the Constitution, then government is only limited by the imaginations of the politicians who get to define those powers for us. And of course, that means there is no limit. And that's exactly what Hamilton wanted. And Hamilton really laid the groundwork for this in his debates with Jefferson. But then he died in 1804. He was killed in a duel with Aaron Burr, a former vice president of the United States. There used to be something called the Aaron Burr Society in America. It was founded by Gary North, and their motto was not soon enough. Now, they were not fans of Hamilton. And then Hamilton, one of his proteges was Chief Justice John Marshall. And Chief Justice John Marshall carried forward this nationalist view of the Constitution that would eventually lead to the Constitution being turned into a rubber stamp document, which it is today. And so, for example, John Marshall invented out of thin air the idea of judicial review by the federal government. There's nothing in the actual original U.S. Constitution about judicial review that says that the Supreme Court will review federal legislation and decide for us whether it is constitutional or not. John Marshall just made this up. And here's what Jefferson himself said about this. I think I didn't dig up see Jefferson quotes. Maybe not. Let's see. No, I thought I had it here. But Jefferson himself I've quoted it, it's in several places in my writings. He wrote a letter to a man named Spencer Rome, who asked him about this question, about who is to interpret the Constitution. And Jefferson's view is, well, the Constitution itself says nothing about this. And so we assume that there were various parties to this contract, and these parties include Congress, President, the federal judiciary, the people of the states, and the people in general. They all have an equal say in interpreting the Constitution. Whereas Marshall tried to open the door to the idea that, no, it's only me, the Chief Justice, who will interpret for you what is and is not constitutional. He also invented the idea that the federal government has a right to veto state court decisions. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that. But John Marshall, as Chief Justice, just declared that the federal government had that power, and so he therefore invented a new power all by himself. He also perverted the meaning of the so-called Supremacy Clause in the United States Constitution. He was the Chief Justice for 36 years, so he had a lot of time to do a lot of damage to the Constitution. And the so-called Supremacy Clause, the words I can paraphrase and say that the federal government is supreme in all these powers, but what powers? Well, the powers that are listed in Article 1, Section 8, there are 18 specific powers that the Congress has given under Article 1, Section 8, primarily for war and foreign policy purposes. And it is only those powers that the federal government is supreme. And moreover, those powers are given by the people of the states to the federal government to be administered for their benefit. That's the way the system was set up. And so so right away you have people like John Marshall reinterpreting this, trying to make people think that the federal government, the central government, is supreme in everything, in whatever it does. They can veto anything, any person, any act of any legislature in any state. That is not at all what the Constitution said. It said only, for example, the state of Massachusetts cannot have its own foreign policy. There will be a national foreign policy, not state-by-state foreign policy. John Marshall also repeated Hamilton's lie about the American founding. And the lie was that the Constitution was somehow ratified by the whole people of the country. Whereas, of course, the reality was the Constitution was ratified by state political conventions, by the citizens of the free, independent, and sovereign states, as they referred to themselves at the time. There was never any national plebiscite over this, over the Constitution. And even if there were, women did not have the right to vote at that time. And, of course, the slaves did not vote, nor did free black people at the time have the right to vote. And so even if there was a plebiscite, which there was not, it would in no way have represented anything near a majority, even, of people. And so this falsehood about the American founding was perpetrated by John Marshall and Hamilton to put out there the false idea that the government that was created by the founding generation was a national government, not a federation, not a confederation of states, which it was, but a national government. And so they were whittling away at the Jeffersonian idea that Calhoun is talking about, of citizens being sovereign and having a right to take control over decisions regarding the constitutionality of legislation. And then the next most important person to take control of this was another justice of the U.S. Supreme Court named Joseph Story. And he wrote a book called Commentaries on the Constitution of the United States. And he repeated all the same myths that Marshall had started up. He first pointed to the preamble of the Constitution that uses the language, we the people. And he did this to make the point that, well, the whole people ratified the Constitution, not the citizens of the states. But he did this in full knowledge that the first draft of the Constitution said, we the people of, and then listed all the states individually, and then the founders recognized, well, wait a minute, we don't know that all these states are going to ratify the Constitution. So we can't say we the people of, you know, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Virginia, Massachusetts, we don't know that Rhode Island, Virginia, and Massachusetts are going to ratify, we just leave it as we the people. That's what happened. And so he lied about that. And he made the argument, as did Marshall and all the other nationalists, that the only thing we Americans should rely on to control the government is elections. Have faith in elections. Because elections are set to express the will of the whole, he said, the will of the people. The next most prominent person to promote this viewpoint was Daniel Webster. He was another famous jurist and politician. And he was in a famous debate with a United States senator from Kentucky named Robert Hayne, H-A-Y-N-E. And I think the Webster-Hayne debate is online. And this is a famous debate over the meaning of the American Constitution. Hayne won the debate hands down, according to all the writing and media of his time. But after the Civil War, this history was rewritten by the victorious nationalists to say that Daniel Webster won the debate, which he did. And so what are some of the main points Webster makes? Well, he repeats the same old Hamiltonian superstition that we should rely only on voting to control the government, that the Constitution was ratified by the whole people. That's a myth. The Supremacy Clause myth is repeated. And also, he's very significantly redefined treason to mean opposition to federal power. Now, in the United States Constitution, Article 3, Section 3 defines treason. And it says treason is only, use the word only, levying war upon the states or providing aid and comfort to their enemies. And so the states were sovereign. The people of the states were assumed to be the sovereign. They were creating this federal government for their benefit. And so forth. Therefore, if some federal government someday were to try to wage war on the states, or levy war upon the states, that would be the one definition of treason under the United States Constitution. Daniel Webster was probably the first, as far as I can tell, to try to redefine that, not by constitutional amendment, but in writing a book, to mean the exact opposition to the federal government. Treasonous, in the words of Webster, during the Webster-Hayne debate. And Abraham Lincoln would adopt this verbatim when he was president by imprisoning tens of thousands of Northern civilians for merely opposing him and his administration without due process, by the way. He suspended the writ of habeas corpus and used Webster's definition of treason. Not the Constitution's definition of treason, but Daniel Webster's and other nationalist definition of treason as opposition to the national state as being treasonous. So when Calhoun is writing his disposition on government, he's writing it after all of this happened. He witnessed the citizens of states north and south and east and west using the Jeffersonian idea of that if the Constitution is ever to be effective as a limit on a governmental abuse, then the citizens of the states will have to do it themselves in political communities organized at the state and local level. He witnessed that. Then he organized the decades-long crusade to whittle away the powers of the Constitution, to rewrite history, and to create a more or less unlimited government where these people were saying, trust us, you can always vote us out next time. And then, of course, the same people would be working diligently to gerrymander the electoral system so that it would become more and more impossible for people to vote anyone out of office, which is pretty much the case today. If you were to go online and search or Google congressional incumbent reelection rates in the U.S., you will find that for the past 40 or 50 years in the U.S., members of the House of Representatives up for re-election, around 90 to 95% are typically re-elected. It's almost impossible to unseat an incumbent, no matter how big the scandal is. And so that's the situation we're in today, where elections don't really work that much. And I just sent away for a bumper sticker I'm going to put on my car a famous quote by Mark Twain that my friends and I friend and I are going to put on our cards that says, if voting, I can paraphrase, if voting made a difference, then they wouldn't let us do it. And I think that's much more true than what Daniel Webster and Joseph Story and John Marshall were saying about having faith in voting as far as the constraints on government. And so these were the comments I plan on making tonight about Calhoun and his disquisition. And because, as I said, the reason I brought up Calhoun is he was Rothbard's favorite American political theorist, not political theorist of all time. And Rothbard, the one big criticism Rothbard had of him, of course, is that he never followed the logic down to allow individual secession. You know, states can secede, and the people of cities could organize, perhaps, as part of this concurrent majority. But Rothbard would have taken it further himself to allow individuals to secede. But Rothbard was not the kind of person who would say, if Calhoun's argument was not perfectly in agreement with my philosophy 100%, I should therefore disavow it or ignore it. Rothbard was a pragmatist. He thought that studying Calhoun and his ideas would advance the cause of liberty. He never said that accepting all of Calhoun's ideas was a necessity any more than he would have said accepting all of Ludwig von Mises' ideas was a necessary thing to be considered to be an Austrian economist. He was not a dogmatist in that regard. Okay. And so I think that's about it. That's 45 minutes, I guess. That's about what I wanted to say about Calhoun for now. And so I'll do the usual. I'll look through and see if we've got some Q&A here. And I'll try to answer the questions if I can. Thanks to Cam for putting all these links on the chat. It sounds great. A lot of good resources here. So feel free. I'll look in the Q&A section here. Let's see, the question from David McLean. What about the seeming inner contradiction that each concurrent majority to be effective relies on its representative being honest and statesmanlike rather than corrupt and demagogic, as Calhoun says they're apt to be? Well, Calhoun and all the other Jeffersonians understood the ancient idea that the Romans understood, that the closer government is to the people, the more likely it is that the people can be successful in controlling the government. Neither Calhoun nor Jefferson was so naive as to think that state or local politicians could not be corrupt, but they thought that the people would have a better chance of controlling them than they would state politicians and then federal politicians. And so, yes, it's not a perfect world, but they're talking probabilities here. The probabilities of having an effect on a national politician are much lower than the probability of influencing a local mayor or city councilman, at least in their day, than anybody else. Let's see, how did Calhoun believe each group would be determined? Well, it would be spontaneous organization by citizens, such as occurred in response to something like the Sedition Act, which outlawed free political speech in America. That's how he foresaw it. He didn't foresee it. He knew that in history this is what had actually happened. So he's not looking forward necessarily. He's looking at not only American history, but other colonial history, even before the government was formed. Concurrent majority can be the citizens of an individual state, for example. And that is a question here from Kevin. And the idea behind the concurrent majority, by the way, is that if the federal government understood in advance, before it passed a law, that groups of citizens, by, for example, organized by state, could say, we believe this is unconstitutional, therefore we will not enforce this law within our territory. Say, you know, there were, back in his day, if there were 30 states, if 10 states would issue resolutions, you know, not ironclad laws, but resolutions just to tell Congress, pay attention, we're not, we think this is unconstitutional, this is why, therefore we want to enforce it in our state. They thought that Congress would be more likely to withdraw that legislation and not pass it, that they would pass, that they would only pass legislation at the federal level that they knew would have a chance of benefiting just about everybody. That's how they, Calhoun thought that it would essentially be a way of enforcing the Constitution, because he did believe that Article 1, Section 8, if you look through the items one by one, a case could be made that these things could all be made to benefit the whole, the general public as a whole for the most part, and were not really geared towards special interest politics. And so that's how I believe that he thought it would work. Let's see, David McLean says, Randy Holcomb's book doesn't mention Calhoun. Well, it's a shame. That's a little political correctness there. Not mentioning Calhoun on a book on democracy in America is a grave mistake, I think. And he talks about the importance of consensus in the early republics, yielding to that requirement. Well, no, this prove anything about Calhoun. In fact, it highlights the importance of Calhoun, because what Calhoun was writing about was the breakdown of any consensus. There might have been more of a consensus in the year 1800, but what Calhoun was warning about was that this consensus was obviously breaking down. When you see the vote on the tariff of 1828 being something like 163 yes votes from northern states and only 3 yes votes from southern states, that's not a consensus. That's northern states trying to use tariff policy to plunder the South through protectionist tariffs. And so Calhoun was the importance of Calhoun's work is that he's trying to find a way out of the inevitable divisiveness of politics. And there never was a consensus about much of anything anyway in American politics. There always was government regulation that benefited special interests in one way or another. It's all a matter of degree. I don't know why Calhoun was afraid of anarchy, so don't ask me. You have to ask Calhoun if you make it up to heaven someday. But I don't know if he's definitely afraid of anarchy, I guess in the context of that era, you know, in consideration of European history being one war after another of the European monarchs, these people understood that there were a lot of wolves in the world who had the control of governments and who would attack you to try to conquer you and steal all your wealth. That's what all the wars between Britain and France and Spain were for generation after generation. In the Middle Ages on, and so that would not dispose one to be in favor of anarchy, I would think. Let's see if there's anything on the chat here. Yeah, Tom Woods has written a book on nullification. Tom is a great popularizer of these ideas, and he wrote a nice little book on nullification. I think somebody mentioned that. So I'm sure he has a YouTube talk about it, too. I'm just looking for another question here. Let's see, Linus is asking, Calhoun talks about liberty and security assigned to their property spheres. What was Rothbard's position on this trade-off? Well, Rothbard didn't see that as a trade-off. Mises did. Mises was wrote in his book Liberalism that you sometimes have to give up freedom now for more freedom in the future. And Hayek said the same thing in The Road to Serfdom and other places. But Rothbard did not believe that. He believed that there is no trade-off, that if you give up freedom now, you give up freedom. And if you give it up to supposedly enlarge the warfare state, you end up with a bigger warfare state and less freedom in reality. In theory, you won't. In theory, you can always spin a theory that says the purpose of the warfare state is to protect our freedom. But if you look at the history of America anyway, I think a great case can be made that the real threat to Americans of their freedoms has always been the government, and the enforcement of this dilution of their freedoms by the army. That's why the founding generation did not want a standing army at all. The original U.S. Constitution only allowed for the funding of an army for 2 years, because they understood that all throughout European history, the purpose of standing armies, like the standing armies that the King of England had, was to abuse the citizens. It wasn't to defend against foreign aggressors so much as it was to enforce regulations, laws, and to collect taxes. And so they did not want a standing army living among them. Eric wants to know if I've noticed any benefits of the living constitution. No, I haven't. And I've been studying these things for 30 years or more, and anybody who speaks of a living constitution is usually a statist who wants to eliminate another remnant of limits on governmental power to the constitution. And so I can't think of any positive developments in terms of usurpations of the constitution. I'll go back to Q&A. Scott Brack, when did standing armies begin to stand around or stay around? Before the American Civil War, there was not much of a standing army. The U.S. Army there were outposts in the West, around the fort to protect settlers from Indians, supposedly, and that was about it, very tiny. Then during the American Civil War, the two great armies were raised by calling up local militias. Governors of each state would call up local militias, and then both sides of the war eventually adopted conscription. And so the standing army was born of the Civil War. And the army was diminished greatly after the Civil War was over, but it never went back to what it was before the American Civil War. And after the Civil War, the army was used for the next several decades to wage war on the Plains Indians. And so that was the next war. And then came the Spanish-American War. So the standing army was adopted, I think, in the years after the American Civil War. And then, of course, it became much more enlarged by the time you get to World War One. Let's see. Question from Charles Strong. Could we consider states allowing medical marijuana as something like a concurrent majority? If so, it does not work very well, as the federal government has simply overridden these laws and closed the marijuana dispensaries. That's sort of a weak example of a concurrent majority making a statement. But the government has so much power nowadays that when the income tax was adopted in the year 1913, that was really, and the Fed the same year, that was really the death of states' rights once and for all. The Civil War put 90% of the nails in the coffin of federalism, which is sometimes called states' rights, and established more or less a federal monopoly in politics. But once the federal government had the money, from the Fed and the income tax to enforce things like conscription and the ability to bribe individuals and governments with all the largesse, well then, whatever the states do, the states can very easily be bought off or extorted by threats to take away federal money or promises to give federal money. And that's usually all the government ever has to do. And it doesn't really need to use violence. It uses threats of taking away federal funding or promises of more goodies if you behave yourself. And so the states after the Civil War all became franchises or appendages of the central government in Washington. And but every once in a while we see a few sputtering slippers of federalism pop up here and there, like the states that tried to sell medical marijuana. But that's and there is a Tenth Amendment movement. You can go online and Google the Tenth Amendment Center, and they have a big collection of articles about things that are going on in the U.S. Attempting to revive federalism or states' rights under the Tenth Amendment. We have something else here. Let's see, where am I? I'm in the Q&A. I'll go back to chat, see if there's any chatting questions. Let's see, Brendan mentioned the 17th Amendment. Yeah, I've written about that years ago. I wrote an article on LouRockwell.com. I think it was the title. It might have been, I think it was just Repeal the 17th Amendment. The year 1913, with the Fed, the income tax, and the 17th Amendment all in one year. In my book, Hamilton's Curse, one of the later chapters is entitled The Revolution of 1913. So I discussed the whole story of the adoption of the Fed, the income tax, and the 17th Amendment in that one chapter in my book, Hamilton's Curse. Okay, let's see if there's any other questions here. Let's go back to Q&A. Let's see, David McLean, what motivated a typical Union soldier to go through such hell and commit such atrocities against his Southern countrymen when the Southerners wished to withdraw? Was Calhoun's vote during the Civil War? Well, Calhoun is still to this day considered to be sort of the ideological inspiration of the South, even though he was dead for 11 years when the Civil War broke out. There's actually a book written by James McPherson, the retired Princeton University historian, who was for years considered to be the dean of Civil War historians in America. And the book is called What They Fought For, 1861 to 1865. And he read through hundreds of letters and diaries of Civil War soldiers, North and South. And he said the typical Southern soldier rode home to his mother, his wife, his girlfriend, his father, siblings, saying that he thought he was fighting against a tyrannical government that was invading his country, burning his towns, threatening his women, and that sort of thing. The typical Northern soldier was fighting for the flag, he said. That's what they thought they were fighting for. And when people joined the militias or were conscripted, they were generally conscripted in units where you would go to war with all the boys you grew up with in your hometown. And so there was a lot of peer pressure and not to run away, although there was massive desertion during the Civil War, especially in the northern side. One of my LouRockwell.com articles is about that, and I can't recall the title I gave it now. I wrote it years ago, but it was a review of a book. I think the book's author was Ellie Lon, L-O-N-N. It was a book on the history of desertion in the Civil War. And there were at times 70,000 to 80,000 Northern soldiers who had deserted on the eve of battle and were hiding out in the mountains of Pennsylvania, places like that. And so so the Northern soldiers were not that highly motivated to fight. Conscription meant you're in the army, and if you did desert, there were firing squads. So on almost a daily basis, the Lincoln administration enforced the shooting of soldiers in front of all the other soldiers who had deserted. And so I guess that'll motivate you to stay in the army, too. So it wasn't just joining, it was conscription. And also, according to historian Clyde Wilson, the northern side in the American Civil War employed as many as 200,000 European mercenaries paid by Lincoln with promises of free land, among other things, to join the U.S. Army. That's why there were so many non-English speaking soldiers in the Northern Army who were paid mercenaries who spoke German mostly, but they were paid. So that's what motivated them. There's a book about this called Melting Pot Soldiers. Let's see if there's anything else in the chat. No questions in the chat. Well, go back to Q&A. Okay, any more questions from the folks in the class? I'll sit here for a couple more minutes, I guess, if it looks like we're slowing down. Well, feel free to email me if you have any other questions or requests, something like that, by the way. David McLean again. My other question about whether Calhoun's theory has been disproved. I'm wondering about its durability, especially given the emergency action proviso. Seems like crisis of Leviathan argument. Well, this is not like a law of physics, Calhoun's theory. It's one version of the states' rights tradition. And so it's not something that was ever really proven. I think what is proven for sure is this discussion of taxpayers versus tax consumers being the inevitable result of democracy. And whether or not a concurrent majority could ever work, I'm not really interested in that. This is a course attempting to understand Calhoun's ideas. I'm not really interested in political applicability of these things, I think it's important to understand some of these ideas. But the federal government has so taken over control of everything in American society today that Americans themselves are just not used to taking control of their own government in any way. They're used to being told what to do. Like the people in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina hit, they were told to go hole up in the football stadium, which they did, and then which was a big house of horrors for several weeks at a time, with murders and rapes and all sorts of awful things happening. So instead of telling them to get in your car and get out of town, they said go sit in the Superdome. That's sort of what millions of Americans have been accustomed to doing, and so Calhoun's idea would not work in American society, I don't think. We would have to break up America into maybe 50 different republics first, and that's my opinion. Right? Any other questions? Make one more attempt at the chat. Eric, Lincoln is known as freeing the slaves. In your mind, did he do it? The 13th Amendment to the Constitution freed the slaves. Slaves were freed after Lincoln died. His famous Emancipation Proclamation, which you can read online, only applied to rebel territory, which was territory in the U.S. where the U.S. government had no ability to free anybody. And so his famous proclamation didn't free anybody. It was a propaganda tool. And he was widely derided and criticized for it during the time. And all of the countries of the world that ended slavery peacefully, ended slavery in the 19th century, and this included the northern states of the United States, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Vermont, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Illinois, in addition to the British Empire, the Spanish Empire, the French, the Danes, the Dutch, the Swedes, they all ended slavery peacefully without a war. And so it could have been done in the United States, in my opinion. But that was never the purpose of the war, according to Abe Lincoln himself. The purpose of the war was to destroy the secession movement and save the Union, as he said. And then the slaves, in my opinion, were used as pawns in the war. But Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation did not free the slaves. I'm not an expert on the Roman Empire, so I can't answer Lewis's question about Calhoun's statement that when the Roman Empire stopped to listen to its enlarging population, it declined. I don't know about that. Calhoun talked about regaining liberty once lost. We have seen some examples of that in the world. We've seen the demise of the Soviet Empire, haven't we? The collapse of socialism worldwide. And so that was surely a lot of liberty lost and then regained. Even in the United States, we did deregulate airlines and trucking in the late 70s, early 80s, and oil prices. So there are a lot of examples in history of liberty regained through politics, it is uncertain and difficult, for sure, but it's not impossible. Any other questions? I'll go to the Q&A one more time here. Scott suggests I use a mic. Well, I used to use a mic for these classes, but the Beethoven Institute gave me this fancy new Logitech webcam that is supposedly better, so I don't know. Okay, well, looks like we've run out of questions, so maybe we'll call it a night for now, gang, and I hope you learned something more tonight, and we'll start getting into sort of more of the nuts and bolts of Rothbardian economics in the next several classes. His discussion of bureaucracy and then taxing and spending is much more economics oriented than political philosophy oriented. And thanks for attending, and everybody have a good night, and keep learning.